Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for December 9th, 2016. This is a podcast of conversations with musicians whose performances you hear on the air at WCRB. This music is Dvorak's Ninth Symphony in a performance by the Boston Symphony Orchestra and conductor Moritz Gnan. On the most recent episode of The Answered Question, I talked with Moritz Gnan about this piece and the rest of the concert he led at Symphony Hall over Thanksgiving weekend. You can hear that entire concert on demand at our website, classicalwcrb.org. And that was the last concert of the first part of the BSO season. Now the Boston Pops is in the midst of their run of holiday programs. You'll hear that program on WCRB in concert a week from Sunday. And in the meantime, we'll have a BSO concert from Tanglewood on the air this Saturday. Giancarlo Guerrero is the conductor of that program, and you'll hear from him later on this podcast. On Sunday this weekend, we have the season opening concert by the Handel and Haydn Society on WCRB in concert. It's an almost all Bach program led by Harry Christophers, and you'll hear it at 7 p.m. on Sunday, and after that, on demand at our website. The program begins with the motet Com Jesu Com, and that's followed by a concerto for three violins. Then there are two cantatas, 149 and 50, that are both based in the story of the Archangel Michael defeating Satan. Another really short choral piece follows, but this one isn't by Bach. It's by Heinrich Schütz, who was a composer Bach studied as he grew up and continued to perform throughout his life. And the concert ends with Bach's Magnificat. You'll hear why the Schütz is part of this program from Handel and Haydn Society Artistic Director Harry Christophers. He's into his eighth season in that position, and he continues to direct the ensemble he founded in Britain, The 16. When I talked with him at Symphony Hall, he told me why he thought of Magnificat for H&H's season opening concert.
It's a great opportunity to show off the talents of the orchestra and the chorus. So that was really my idea, and also to give a sort of overview of Bach. I mean, the Magnificat is so short, it's over in a flash, really, and you just sort of wish that he had extended it. But on the other hand, actually, it is such a sort of perfect piece. And the other thing, I tried to sort of latch on to two things, to St. Michael's Day, closest by, and so, put two cantatas in for that. I think, my memory corrects me, I think Bach only wrote three cantatas for St. Michael's Day, and these two are great. And the other thing, when you're putting together a programme, when you've got the trumpets there and you've got all the woodwind for the Magnificat, you've got to try and use them somewhere else in the programme. So that's always sort of shapes my ideas. But then I wanted to have a showcase for the orchestra and for the chorus. So chatting to Aisin about what we did, and she said, well, look, why not? Let's put this sort of idea, this reconstruction of the triple violin concerto. And I thought it was a brilliant idea. We've got Aisin, Christina and Susanna, these wonderful players in the orchestra. Let's see what they're doing. And I adore the motets. So, what better than to start with Com Jesu Com, which is, it's just perfection. And then, when you're trying to work this sort of program in, I just felt I needed a little something in the second half. And I thought, right, okay, we've got a Magnificat, why not have an Agnomitis? So let's go from a precursor of Bach to Schütz and put something that, Bach would have definitely played, sung, etc., and studied. I think it's a lovely sort of moment of repose. I just think important, as I say, to have a very varied program and show what we're capable of.
Well, there's so much that you said that I now have to unpack with you because that's all great. And it's sort of a lot of that occurred to me as I think he's probably thinking of this kind of thing. But let's just start with Schütz because it is sort of the outlier, and yet it's not. It's so central to what Bach became, who he was as the person who was... I don't know quite how to phrase it, but the precursor as one of the most important composers of that part of the world. When was the first time that you encountered Schütz? Was that early on, or
very long time ago? I mean, it was at university, the Psalms of David, but also one of the pieces that I had the biggest impact on me was the Musicalis Exequien, which of course ends with the Magnificat. Three movements, very, very long first movement of the first anthem, and then this double chorus, and then finishing with the Nunc Dimittis. Extraordinary writing. I mean, it's very interesting because, you know, you see the sort of way the vocal textures have changed by Bach. I mean, Bach, of course, is so wonderfully inventive. Schütz, particularly in the Nunc Dimittis we're doing, it's very what I call sort of middle textured. It relies on this sort of altos, two tenor parts very often occurring in Schütz. So you get this sort of inner texture that is underlying a little bit, I suppose, like, you know, the way viola parts figure heavily in Purcell or something like that. But in the way we approached it, when we've got all this effervescent Bach around in this particular program, I asked the chorus to really sort of sing in a real line, to sing the suspensions, to go into the suspensions, work the sound. Don't be scared of them, actually. You know, go further than you think you should. And, you know, that's been fascinating for them. And also just, you know, subtle deliveries of the text. You know, Schütz is coming out of, you know, that very much Renaissance world of imitation, simple imitation, simple structure of, you know, how he uses the top voices against the lower voices and then interacts them. But there's also, even in this very short Nunc Dimittis, there's great rhythmic drive. And I would love to do more. It's one of these funny things. You know, record companies don't like Schütz. They say, I remember Ted Perry, the late Ted Perry of Hyperion Records in England. Now, I said once, I wanted to do Schütz. And he said, Harry, no, Schütz doesn't sell. Anyway, so I'll change that. One day I'll start doing a lot more. I mean, I've got complete works of Schütz at home from the wonderful German edition that was done. You know, bit by bit, we'll get round to doing it. And it's great.
Well, and the thing is that I think for the audience to hear this very short Schütz piece right before the Magnificat, it can't help but affect how they hear Magnificat. And I wonder, and I don't know anything about how your rehearsal schedule was, but I wonder, did you find, after working through with Schütz and talking to the singers about leaning into those dissonances and everything, did that kind of affect how they perform Magnificat in the end?
I think possibly, yes. I mean, what I always with the chorus make them do is to actually make sure they score it, they don't get bogged down in their own parts, and look at what's happening, look at the imitation that's happening in Bach, as in Schütz. And yes, and get into the text and get into the words. And what was interesting, you know, we did the first concert this particular weekend, talking to audience members afterwards, and so many of them were bowled over by the Schütz. And, you know, to say it's a palate cleanser is wrong. It's a sort of disservice to Schütz, but it is a completely different text. Having said that, you know, we get an echo of it sort of in the secret locutus est, the penultimate movement of the Magnificat, where Bach very much goes into sort of Stile Antico type style for that before he lets us rip on the final Gloria.
When we talked before at one point, we were talking about motets, and you described to me, we were talking about Jesu meine Freude, but the way you described the approach to motets is, I remember very clearly you said you kind of have to take an instrumental approach to conducting these pieces. Does that carry into Comme Jésus Comme?
Not so much. Okay. I mean, Comme Jésus Comme is the most, of all the funeral motets he wrote, it's the most delicate. These wonderful invocations to Jesus at the opening. It's clearly a piece, in my mind, where Bach accepts death, but he also sees the hope in it. And he allows himself also to have a little bit of dance. But it is delicate. And I've changed my interpretation. When I first used to do Comme early years, I used to be quite sort of overt with it and make the gestures, particularly at the opening, quite strong. But I've totally changed my thoughts on it. And I regard it as a very delicate piece. Completely different to Jesu meine Freude. But, you know, Bach goes through, he gives us so many, the usual thing, he gives the singers so many forms. It's, and there is instruction. I mean, I'm sure when Bach was writing these pieces that this was not only, he was not only writing a wonderful piece, but he was also instructing his singers in various forms, etc. And, you know, how to shape a double choir motet, how to use imitation, how to use fugue, etc., etc. But there's a definite feeling for me in the plaintive nature of, you know, I yearn, the desire of the bitterness, and, you know, the way he paints. When you see it on the page with bar lines, it's not a first beat of the bar pulse. So many times the word stress is going to the second beat and it's making us sort of yearn, making us look forward. There's a direction in the music. And I get conceit right from the beginning to get, we have the com repeated three times. Then fourth bar, two choirs coming together, but only one choir carries on the words, com Jesu com. So he's giving us this direction the whole time. And then, you know, we get into the next section of the movement where he takes us into 4-4. And there's this element of dance, and it's so graceful, it's so delicate, so beautiful. And the 6-8 flourish is brilliant. And it has a really, the working on the melismas in this passage, handing over from one choir to another, it's identical almost in music to the final chorus of Handel's Alexander's Feast. Now, of course, we can't date. We don't know the dates for sure of the motets. So who came first? You know, chicken and the egg. You know, but I'm pretty certain. Obviously, you know, Handel used numerous people's other works. I mean, it's a sort of very obvious structure, but they are very similar.
That's fascinating. That's fantastic. I love this. I love this this idea that the rhythm is making us feel the longing. I mean, that is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a motet of great yearning, and as I said before, one of immense hope. The final chorale, he calls it aria actually for the text at the end, is so beautiful, and there's so much in it, and it just raises our hopes at the end, and. You know, what I'm so pleased at the way the chorus have done this is that, you know, they really are singing the words, they're singing the text, they're believing it, and they're making it live through music. But what I've done, which is rather is slightly unusual, and people may sort of wonder, and part of the reason was because we were in Symphony Hall, I've actually doubled all the vocal lines with strings. You know, there were instances, Der Geisthilft, one of the other double choir motets, there were instrumental parts where we had wind band and strings doubling. There's no reason. It's simple collar party, so the strings adding a very subtle colour on top of it. I have to say, I think it works quite well.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned before that the Cantato 149 is associated with St. Michael's Day, which is September 29th. So yes, this is the time of year for it, right? And yet, I'll just, from a personal point of view, not just because I was a trumpet player, but I just love the St. Michael's cantatas. I mean, I think they're all just mind-boggling because partly that sort of duality that's going on with that day of protection and battle sort of at the same time, right? What was it about 149 that made it your choice to do? Because there's so many cantatas that you could choose from. And even when you narrow it down to a specific day or time of year, there's still a lot to choose from. What is it about 149 that made you want to bring it to this program?
It's very rarely done anyway, in my opinion. And it's a real... I mean, as you say, it's Archangel Michael, but it's a real triumph of good over evil. You get the feeling right from the beginning. And what is incredible about it is just the simple way, you know, Bach uses three choirs of instruments with the chorus. So you've got all these independent lines. You know, you've got the three trumpets and drums, then you have the three oboes and then you have the strings with a bassoon, independent bassoon part that is just chirping in a very rhythmic aspect, and then the choir the text. It's unusual, of course. The text is by most of the text is by Picander, of course, famous for Matthew Passion, and it's an incredible opening movement, and of course we've got the chorale at the end. And for those who have never heard the piece, I'm not going to spoil the ending because it's just so unexpected and amazing. And then within it, you've got some very tricky arias, and a lot of debate about what exactly they were scored for, whether the bassoon did play both the bass aria as well as the duet at the end. I've actually in the new Bach edition. It's very interesting they put the source of a violone part there accompanying the cello, and I've used the cello on the bassoon on this because I think it suits it better with the bass aria at the beginning. I mean, fantastic piece. I mean, great for it's a marvelous opportunity for me to use the lovely things we have from the chorus and put them out the front of the stage, and they have to deliver the text in a great way. Recitatives are always I find them, you know how I love Handel as well. I mean, I find recitatives absolutely phenomenal. In 10 or 12 bars, you can go through so many different colours and scents, and the way we shape the secco chords and the recitative, whether they might be sustained or using the figures. Very interesting with Bach, you know, you've got, as with the Passions, you have, in the Evangelist parts and the Passions, you've got all the figures there, the continua figured bass. The decision, really, I think, today is, you know, how many of those do you actually use? How many of those are inherent in what you're hearing? Do you actually need them? Or are they adding some sort of substance to it? So whether, we have no idea exactly whether Bach, how much, you know, they play with him. It's one of those things of time. I suspect the more times those pieces were performed, then something different would happen. But we have time to rehearse them, so we can decide for our own selves and put our own sort of interpretation onto that. The soprano aria in the middle of 149 is just delightful. I've varied that again. I've taken the decision to vary that between full strings and solo strings. Solo strings accompanying the voice when that comes in, allowing the voice not to be drowned, and also allowing the interest. There's a hell of a lot of interest in the viola part, particularly. I mean, there's interest in all parts, but I just love the way Bach uses his viola parts. He's never static with them. He's never just filling in a harmony. There's something of interest going on the whole time. And of course, the other cantata 50 was, you know, this debate, was it part of a bigger thing? I don't think so, actually. I think it's a wonderful standalone movement. It's just great. You know, it's what, 3 minutes 50 probably in length, 4 minutes maximum. And a brilliant use of just dictating the text at the beginning and then allowing what I call the filigree in the other choirs around it, and the trumpets having these phenomenal fanfare moments. It's brilliant. Again, this use of the way he uses the various orchestral choirs, I use the word choirs, because I think it is a very choral effect, polychoral textures, I suppose. It's going back to the Gabrielles and all those sort of things, the way it just fires from instruments to instrument in different contours. And the interesting thing with the trumpets, that in a way they're, one should think of them as extension of the oboes. So it's not a blazon sound, it's a sound that's going to blend. Because actually, if you have, this is the big difference between having a modern orchestra playing it, where modern drummers are there to get to the back of the symphony hall in a blazon way, and then, well, you're going to lose the oboes text, and you'll lose the string texture. So everything is focusing really well from part to part, which is great.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you anticipated mainly my next question, which was about Cantata 50, but that's great. Do you ever concern yourself with these debates about did he even write it at all? Is it part of a larger...
Not important to me. I mean, I just, you know, I'm here to perform the music, and I just I love it. I try not to get into too many academic debates. Academics will always win over those. And, you know, we're here to convey the music and make the music live.
Okay, so this takes me back actually to that conversation we had about motets, because another part of that was about the weight of academia in historically informed performance and how that can just sap all the life out of what you're doing, and you have to maintain this balance. And I just wonder, it doesn't seem like it seems like you have a very easy time navigating that balance.
The thing is, today we have so many wonderful academics about. I mean, there are, and you've got everything at your fingertips. You know, I can pick up, you know, Larry Dreyfus's book on Bach and the art of the continual use. Now, you know, I will open it and I'll look to see what Larry has to say about X, Y, Z. You know, use of bassoon in those numbers, use of violone. But then in the end, it's up to us to... depending on where we're performing it. Here we're doing it in Symphony Hall. Of course, we've got to make some sort of adjustments. We've got to use things in certain moves of the Magnificat. I've got a slightly bigger continuo section just to give it that, to give the vocal elements that little bit more support. These are judicious decisions that actually, I'm sure, you know, Bach was as practical as we are.
Yeah, no question. One quick other question. You've mentioned a couple times you're highlighting the players and the singers of the chorus. You didn't hire guest soloists to come in and do Magnificat with you or the cantata. You're bringing those solos straight out of the choir, featuring Susanna and Christina and Aislinn. And just tell me about your 8 years and the evolution of what's happened here during that time and how you're feeling about it at this point.
I'm feeling really good about it. I mean, it has evolved. I mean, you know, when a new person comes in, there's always things that are going to change and, you know, a different style. Not necessarily needed, but you know, you're going to need to approach things in a slightly different way. What I've really noticed and what I've tried to do, and I think that's really showing now, I've just tried to release people a little bit more. I really wanted to get the performers, both instrumentalists and vocalists, to actually give it themselves, give it their own musicality and their personalities a little bit more. What's wonderful about, you know, H&H and the Period Orchestra is that they know so much about their instruments. They're fantastic, and there's so much wealth of information there, that, you know, which is brilliant, which I feed off, and allowing them to express themselves, I think, is the great thing. And Baroque music is all about that. Is about expression. Is about individuality, and then the same with the singers. You know, making them aware of the text. You know, I'm not. It's very funny because when I first came, I remember the element I was very worried about was the chorus. I didn't know whether I knew what to say, put it that way. I started the 16 back in 1979. That's the only choir I've ever done. So I'm not, although I come, you know, I was a chorus choir at Oxford, etc., and all those things, but I also played the clarinet. I conducted quite a lot of orchestras, but I wouldn't call myself a choral man. I don't go out doing choirs all over the world. There are lots of people who do that, and that's wonderful. They have great enjoyment. So, you know, when I came with the chorus, I was a bit worried, you know, could I actually achieve what I wanted to? But it was simple, because when I came, I felt that, you know, they sang wonderfully together, but the words didn't seem to matter. And to me, you know, What's vocal music without words? We have to be dictated by the text and make the text live and breathe. When we do Bach, of course, every singer is going to say Bach is so difficult. But actually, we make our breaths part of the music. We make its shape out of it. We rely much, much more on working the architecture of the shape, the phrase, the contours, where the music is going, where it's going harmonically, where Bach is being led by the text. He's always led by the text. He's a great composer. So, you know, we just need to have belief in it more and actually stop saying it's difficult, and actually finding a way, let's work around it. You know, the prime example, you know, something like Et exultavit in the Bach Magnificat, long phrase, you know, where do you breathe? Well, you breathe with the punctuation and you make that work, and you make the continuo listen without the continuo being over incisive. They have to back off when the word is unimportant, or, you know, the syllable is unimportant, and they come out of it the other way. I call it so often, I call it turning the corner. You turn the corner on the phrase, you sort of pull slightly into it, but then you work your way out of it. And to me also, there's one of the things I think I got rid of when I very first came, and it's taken a few years to actually get rid of it completely, is the idea of a metronome. You know, we need flexibility. We have to have ebb and flow in the music, light and shade. And just making people aware sometimes that with the singers we need to think of things sometimes instrumentally, and with the orchestra sometimes we need to think of things vocally, and actually constant awareness of that. You don't have to be uniform. If the second violins have a leading passage as is harmonic, they don't have to be doing the same bow stroke as the first violins. We were a little bit sort of, I felt, you know, straitjacketed into music. If the bowing's not there or the articulation's not there in the copy, we don't do it, rather than actually sort of making music, believing in ourselves and actually being individual.
And I'm going to hit pause on this conversation with Harry Christophers for just a sec, because when we got to this part of the interview, we began talking more about Bach's Magnificat. And as you'll hear, Harry began going through at rapid pace all kinds of great details about the challenges of the piece. I thought it might be helpful to have some musical reference points along the way, so I did a bit of editing. But because Magnificat is one of the small handful of pieces that really made me want to pursue music, after I played in the trumpet section for a performance of the piece in college, I asked Harry about his first encounter with this music.
I only came to it after university days, actually. So, and at modern pitch at 440, and I remember as a tenor, it's cruel, trying to sing the Deposuit, not easy at all. So we got the bonus of period instruments and Baroque pitch, which is great. But it is brilliant. I mean, what is I just find staggering about it is, you know, this is Bach's first season, you know, his first time at first season in Leipzig, you know, 1723. He had, if I correct me, so 7 feet between Christmas and the first Sunday after Epiphany, 7 feast days to write for. And of course, the Magnificat was, he wrote in E flat with sort of Christmas propers, you know, little movements in between. Massive commitment, not only for Bach to have to write all this music, but for the performers. You know, how did they cope with this incredible challenge? And I remember I said to our guys when we were rehearsing the other day, I said, it's like, you know, it's like asking Harry Birtwistle to write a different piece, you know, for every concert, and we've got to rehearse it and perform it. So, you know, those are the challenges, and they are challenges. The Magnificat is immense. I mean, but again, you know, Bach using, he's got the big orchestra. He's got his three trumpets. He's got his drums. He's got two flutes, oboes, bassoon, strings, chorus, and what does he do? He utilizes every single element. The Suri enters with those two little lovely sort of chirping flutes in it. The amazing oboe, you know, solo, the third movement, which is just so haunting, an oboe, De Moris solo, which is immensely haunting. And it's just the outrageous way he gets from one movement to another. You know, when you think of the Omnes Gentes, when that starts after Qui Our Respects It. It's an incredible bit of writing, and I think we just have courage to be overtly dramatic and expressive with it. You know, you have to do things. So, you know, after the Et Misericordia, which is this beautiful movement with strings muted, with flutes, colla parte with the first and second violins, this wonderful texture. Strings have to take their mutes off to be there, ready for Feci Potentiam. He doesn't have them coming in for three beats, but we still have to give that sort of moment of repose before we go crashing in with the Feci Potentiam. Loads of things of balance we need to think about. End of the Feci Potentiam moment, we have the mente cordis, where the oboe, first oboe has an independent line for about three beats. We have to let it through before the words repeat and the trumpets and everything bring in for the final ending. It's very, very clever writing. We've been sort of meticulous about making sure we try and balance every aspect. And as I said before, you know, the first trumpet has this ridiculous part. They must have been damn good.
Lyle, you know. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Well, as you're kind of going through some of these movements, the other one that is just haunting, but depends so much on, I think, timing in terms of how you perform it, is to Shepit Israel.
Oh, so it's beautiful. I actually do it with full choirs, SSA. It's beautiful, and it is a typical geographical movement. It's the arch is the phrase. The phrase goes up and the phrase descends. And if you treat, you know, that small crescendo as the phrase goes up, small diminuendo as the phrase comes down, and just allow the music to sort of speak out of that, then it goes into that really old, the old-fashioned Palestrina style secut, locut, and then you're into the Gloria. Which is just outrageously brilliant. And, you know, three statements, you know, Gloria, Gloria Patri, Gloria Filio. Crashing in, da ba da da ding. It's incredible, and then it's almost Bach just being cheeky. The secret locut is, it's so short, it's over in a flash, and so it should be. So, you know, we don't wallow in it. We just go and it's done.
Yeah,
and that's your Magnificat, and for the audio, I mean. For the for the congregation, listening to that, that just means stunning.
Yeah, no, I've often wondered about that first Christmas when it was played. Just what they must have thought they got themselves into with this guy. He'd already sort of announced himself through a lot of other pieces.
Well, quite.
But then this on Christmas morning, this thing shows up, and it's like nothing he had ever written. He hadn't written, if I'm correct about this, he hadn't written a 5-part. Choral before.
No,
this was the first.
This was the first, and it is absolutely staggering. I mean, there may have been people in those congregations who thought, "What the heck's this? I don't like this modern music." But you know, but I mean, we just live to relish in his just incredible inventiveness. And for me, as always with Bach, it's his orchestration. It's the way he uses every single instrument in his vocabulary and the people who've got there, and use them in such important, delicate ways, triumphant ways, emotional ways, sad ways, happy ways. It's brilliant, and constantly making demands and challenges. They were clearly incredibly difficult then, but they are as difficult now as they were then.
Question. Harry, thanks you so much for
Great pleasure, Brian. Thank you very much indeed.
Harry Christophers is the artistic director of the Handel and Haydn Society, and you can hear the entire Magnificat and the rest of their almost all Bach season opening concert this Sunday night at 7 p.m. at 99.5 FM in Boston, or streaming at classicalwcrb.org. That's also where you'll be able to hear that concert again on demand. On Saturday, while the Boston Pops is playing their holiday program at Symphony Hall, you'll hear on the radio a concert the Boston Symphony performed at Tanglewood last August. Giancarlo Guerrero is the conductor, and Yefim Bronfman is the soloist in the second piano concerto by Liszt. The program also includes the Serenade for Winds by Dvorak, an arrangement of part of Mahler's Third Symphony by Benjamin Britten, and the second Serenade by Brahms. Giancarlo Guerrero is the music director of the Nashville Symphony, and last summer at the Kuzovitsky Music Shed, my colleague Alan McClellan asked him to describe the feeling of leading the Boston Symphony.
The best analogy I can have when you're a guest conductor of an ensemble of this caliber is literally like driving a Ferrari, a Lamborghini, a Rolls Royce, a Bentley, a Cadillac, a Corvette. It's just such an amazing music-making machine that it is really humbling for a conductor to get in front of an ensemble that can literally ask and do anything that you ask of them, musically, artistically, and plus they're some of the nicest people on earth. So I cannot imagine a better condition to make absolute great music in a beautiful natural surrounding.
And tonight's program is such a charming one, isn't it? I mean, what a lovely thing, serenades and these unusual pieces in between.
Absolutely, and this program kind of came together because it gives an opportunity to reduce the size of the orchestra. As you know, this orchestra works quite hard during the summer season with many performances, not only on stage, but also teaching and mentoring and coaching. And so this is kind of a chance for them to you know, take a little bit of a relaxation, particularly the violins who play every concert. They actually don't play in two of the pieces tonight. The music tends to be much more intimate. It tends to be much more, you know, inwardly. It's not as flashy, but yet it's some of the most beautiful ever music ever written, with some of the most beautiful melodies. Plus, it also gets to showcase individuals of the orchestra, and the audience is going to get to appreciate even more so the amazing soloists that make up the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
And you get to conduct just the winds in the Dvorak Serenade. That must be a different experience.
It is amazing, because I also get to do that without a podium. So I literally get to be so close to them. Remember also that that serenade particularly has one string bass and one cello as well. So as I said, a few players get to have a moment in the spotlight, which to me was another reasoning for putting this program together. As I said, as you see, the ensemble is amazing, but to be able to get the Boston Symphony, you need the individual players to make it happen. And after these two serenades, which are very reduced, I think the public will get a wonderful sense, even more so, of the amazing level of virtuosity individually that makes up this orchestra.
It's incredible, really. And the outdoors is kind of a theme. Are you an outdoors person?
I am. Well, I grew up in Costa Rica, and, you know, we are known for our national parks, and growing up in a city that has both oceans within a couple of hours' drive, we grew up basically surrounded by nature. And this is my second time in Tanglewood, and I do have to say that you just get that inspiration. The combination of great music with the beauty of nature is just absolutely perfect, and you put on top of that one of the great ensembles in the face of this earth, you just can't go wrong.
Have you worked with Yefim Brofman before?
Yes, Fima is a dear friend, and we have collaborated a few times. It's been a couple of years, so it was nice to catch up with him, and this is the first time we're doing the Liszt second. We've done some Beethoven, we've done some Bartok, and some Chopin and Rachmaninoff, but first time exploring Liszt second concerto, so I'm very excited to get to share the stage with him.
It's such an interesting piece. It takes the thematic metamorphosis to an extreme.
I'm going to be honest with you. The Liszt Second Concerto before the last couple of years was never my favorite. I've never conducted it until 2 years ago. And I remember coming to it like, well, you know, it's okay. I mean, I guess I'll have to do it. Pianists love to do it. But then once I got up on the podium, I came to realize, you know what? This is one of the greatest pieces. I mean, I need to appreciate it actually on the podium and making music. And now I can understand why audiences love it so much. It has everything you expect from a composer like Liszt. Remember, he was probably among the first real rock stars of his time. I mean, he was basically on every tabloid. I mean, there were women that were always claiming paternity and everything from him. So, I mean, he started kind of the whole tabloid paparazzo thing before it even existed. So this music is just for one purpose, is to showcase the soloist. And when you do that, it is quite an amazing adventure. And nobody better than Fima with that amazing level of chops that he has to pull it off. And remember, Liszt was also Richard Wagner's father-in-law, so he knew a few things about orchestration. So I do have to say that I was sorry that before the last couple of years I wasn't really much of a fan, but now I got to tell you, I cannot wait for the next opportunity to do it. And this is only my second time that I'm doing the piece, but I cannot wait to do it again.
What is it that Brofman brings to it that's particularly special?
There are two things. First, this piece, because it was written by Liszt, it is only available to monster virtuosic pianists, which he had. But at the same time, it has a lot of lyricism. So you cannot let just the virtuosity and the flashiness take over. In the middle of that, you have to play elegantly. You have to play with a sense of musicality, which can be very difficult because sometimes people just focus on the fireworks. And Fima really brings the combination of both. And he brings it with such ease, too. I got to tell you, from the podium, I look down and I see all those many notes. And I got to ask myself, how is he putting them all together? I would like to have a slow motion camera. It is absolutely remarkable, but he makes it seem so easy and so beautifully elegant that I think it does a great service to a piece that I think in many ways gets underrated because the first concerto is so popular.
I get the sense that Liszt was that way too, in the sense of he was not all about himself and putting himself forward.
Not only that, I mean, Liszt was known to champion the new music and the new composers of his day. I mean, he was kind of at the end of that, but he was a great champion of other young composers during his time that were just coming up. So not only did he encourage them to play his music, but he himself played their music. And you have to remember that it was really Liszt who saved Beethoven's music. After Beethoven's death, nobody was really picking up the mantle. And Liszt himself not only conducted a lot of his music, but more importantly, transposed the symphonies into piano so people would be able to hear them. So in many ways, we owe Liszt rescuing Beethoven after his death to make sure his music would not be forgotten.
That's a perfect transition to Britten and his admiration for Mahler. That's an amazing piece that we have.
It is. And this one is basically the second movement of the Mahler's Third Symphony. Originally, this symphony, which is the longest of the symphonies, is 6 movements long. Originally, Mahler added titles to each of the movements. Very much like Mahler as a conductor, he kept changing his mind. And each of the movements, the first one did not have a title, it was just introduction, but the second movement was called What the Wildflowers Tell Me. The third movement was What the Animals Tell Me. The fourth movement is What the Universe Tells Me. And then the last one is What Love Tells Me, which is absolutely remarkable. But then Mahler, being Mahler, said, you know, audience, they don't need the titles. You know, they should be able to get it just by listening to the music. So he took them out and just called them, you know, first, second, third, fourth movement. Britain loved Mahler's music. He adored it. At a time when, again, Mahler was not very well known in the 1930s and the 1940s. And he heard the Third Symphony and fell in love with the second movement. But because, like Mahler, the music is so thickly orchestrated with 9 French horns, 4 trombones, the kitchen sink, the canons, you name it, he wanted to be able to play it more regularly. So what did he do? He reduced it for a chamber orchestra. And that's the version we're going to do. And Britain, even more so, added the original title, What the Wildflowers Tell Me.
And it's a beautiful thing. It's an amazing piece.
It was always, of all this massive symphony, it is the most intimate of the movements. And as I said, a title like that in a place like Tanglewood, incredibly relevant.
It's so relevant. And this program brings it all out. And I was going to ask you about Nashville, because you're the music director of the Nashville Orchestra. What's it like, and I'm sure you get asked this all the time, what's it like to be the representative of classical music in a town that's so known for popular music?
Oh, it is the greatest honor, because Nashville is Music City. But I would add to that, it is American Music City, because every music of every American genre is being performed, published, recorded, commissioned, composed every single day. Jazz, rock and roll, bluegrass, country, gospel. I just happen to be doing it in my field, in classical music. And that has received a great relevance in our community, that the audience understands that this is very important. Unlike Liszt during his time, you have to champion your composers of the day. Otherwise, we're going to run out of repertoire. I am a strong believer of that. And you know who I use as an example? The Boston Symphony and Serge Koussevitzky. If it wasn't for him and his dedication to the composers of his time, we probably wouldn't know a lot of the people that we now take for granted. So in many ways, I look back and I say, it is up for us musicians and conductors to make sure we give a voice to the current composers so they become the warhorses of tomorrow. And in a place like Nashville, known as Music City, we happen to be focusing on American composers, and that makes us very, very proud, because we commission them, we record them, and we give them a voice.
That's so great. And you get a great response there, I think.
We do. The audience loves it. And, you know, we've won Grammys, and it's been a wonderful project for us.
Speaking of newish music, tomorrow night you are presenting John Adams. What is special about the Harmony Lehre?
John Adams gets to enjoy something that many composers and many great artists never got to enjoy, which is success during his lifetime. John Adams is by far the most performed classical living composer of his time, period. Nobody even comes close. And Harmony Lehre is from 1986, and that was really the big first orchestral piece that put him on the map. He wrote it for the San Francisco Symphony, and since then he's become one of the most performed pieces. It is just an absolute celebration of orchestral writing. There's no better way of putting it. I mean, there are so many great sounds and great colors that come out of this piece, and such great emotion, because it's a very personal piece for him. He wrote this, the last movement is actually called Meister Eichert and Quacky, with Quacky being the nickname of his youngest daughter Emily, who at the time was a baby. So there's a lot of him personally in this music.
John Adams's daughter.
Yes. And I remember being in college, and my teacher, conducting teacher, said, go listen to this piece. And I remember going to it, to listen to it, the only recording available with the San Francisco Symphony. And from the very beginning of the opening chords, I was just hooked. And since then, it has been what I like to call one of my party pieces. But you do need an orchestra of the caliber of the Boston Symphony to pull it off, because John had the San Francisco Symphony at his disposal. So he didn't mince any words and notes when it came to orchestral writing.
It's a big party piece.
It's a huge party piece. And more importantly, you know what? This is the closest thing I can think of the classical music version of a heavy metal tune. Every single time I've done this piece, the audience just goes crazy. I'm not kidding you. It's like being at a Black Sabbath, AC/DC, Rolling Stones concert. This is the best presentation I can think of what classical music in the 20th and 21st century can do, which is truly to move people beyond their abilities. And this is music that showcases what our current time is. Beethoven wrote and was a reflection of his time. The same with Mozart, the same with Stravinsky. John Adams, I think, is giving a voice of what is actually taking place, the good and the bad of the 20th century, and is able to remind us that orchestras have a very important role to play in the current world.
I was speaking to one of the violinists, and they told me that you told the story of that Meister Eckhart movement to the orchestra.
Yeah, well, that movement, as I said, is very personal because Meister Eckhart was a philosopher from the 12th, 13th century, and John had a dream. He very specific that he had a dream while he was composing this, where Meister Eckhart comes from the cloud, goes into Emily's room, whose nickname was Quacky, and basically lifts her up and then takes her in a rocking feel all over the world and shows her the beauties of the world, at the same time whispering the secrets to happy life and to the universe in her ear. And it is such a beautiful thought of this, to have somebody come in and share that with the closest person to you, your daughter, your kids. I myself have two daughters. And it's such a beautiful thing that I think when I told that story to the orchestra, it changed their visualization of the piece. And to many of them, it became a personal issue as well.
Yeah, the one person I was talking to was very, very enthusiastic about it. Pianist Ingrid Fleeter has stepped in here, and what a thrill to be able to work with her, a fellow Latin American.
Yes, yeah. Ingrid is a dear friend. I was very much looking forward to working with Daniil again, but that's what's happening, I think, in this world nowadays. I mean, we have so many amazing artists, and Ingrid has been a dear friend for many years. We have never done the Chopin 2 before, but we've done Schumann and Beethoven's and a few other things. So when this happened, the Boston Symphony called me and said, do you have any names you might want to recommend? And Ingrid was at the top of my list because I knew that Chopin is one of her specialties. And I know that after even the first movement in the rehearsal on Wednesday, the orchestra started clapping. They were truly like, wow, this is amazing. And this is her debut with the orchestra. So in many ways, I'm very proud of the fact that I'm introducing her to the orchestra and to this audience. And it's one of the great concertos, like the Liszt. I mean, a wonderful pianist. But I do have to say, from a conductor's point of view, it's one of the most difficult pieces to accompany because every measure is a rubato. Every measure moves. This music is completely free. It feels like a recitative from an opera. It's never settled. So there's a lot of movement. So you have to know that piano part, you know, perfectly. And I tell the orchestra, I say, you ever want to do conductor auditions, you have them conduct the second movement. If they can do that, they can do anything. I promise you. This is probably the most difficult thing for me in the whole two programs that I'm doing in Tanglewood.
Kind of like conducting a singer then. I mean, recitative, you said.
Even more so. The problem is that with a singer, they can only sing 5-6 notes at a time. Here, literally, there are times when you have a measure and there are 64 notes. So how do you catch her at the end? So I always think of myself as like being like a butterfly catcher with a net. And I'm literally just going around and I will land some of them. And I promise you, some of them might not be quite there. But that's what you expect. I mean, Chopin wanted this music to be completely spontaneous. And as a conductor, you literally have to guess on the spot, right before it happens, where she's going. And with the Boston Symphony in hand, I promise you, we're all on the edge of our seats. And just after today's rehearsal, she made it seem so easy because it's so logical and so musical that it doesn't take much for me to realize what she wants to do. And because I like her, we like each other as friends and as colleagues, chemistry helps a lot in music like this.
And she has this tremendous fluidity. I mean, I'm so impressed with her. Fantastic. Yeah. So I was just going to ask you about Till Eulenspiegel, because what fun. I mean, this whole experience of these two concerts is so much fun.
And let's end with a comedy. Till Eulenspiegel, and I told the orchestra, was a character, of course, also from German literature, who got in trouble, a mischievous character who kept getting into trouble by playing pranks on people. And eventually he played a prank on the local archbishop. And that basically, I mean, that's a punishable by death, which happens at the end. I mean, very tragically, he gets sentenced to death. But his spirit lives on. And in many ways, this is music that showcases that we need humor. And in many times, in moments of protest, humor is the best way to diffuse the opposition. Nobody perfected that better than the Russians, particularly in Shostakovich's time and Prokofiev's time, that they had to be very careful about what they wrote. But underneath the music, there was a message of almost like sticking your tongue out to authority, which kind of is in the human DNA. But what's amazing is that everybody gets the joke except the people who are being made fun of. They think they're being paid tribute, and no. Underneath, everybody gets, you know what, you're a bunch of idiots. And we all understand what Till Eulenspiegel was trying to do, which was very innocent. And the music, and I told the orchestra in the rehearsal, I said, you know, this is your one chance to be really mean and bullying. We don't get to do that in real life, fortunately, but in music, we can do it. So please, my friends, I said, aim it at me as the conductor. Really stick your tongue out and really nail me for these things, because this music requires that. It puts a smile on your face because it's very childish. Even though Tilman Spiegel eventually becomes an adult, it is always done in a very childish and in a very humorous way. And of course, authority, they don't get it. So as I said, the piece ends tragically, but Tilman Spiegel gets the last laugh. So although he's no longer with us in body, he's with us in spirit. And that inspires many other people to continue that legacy of making sure that we remain simple and we remain humorous. And laughter, I think, is what's going to save the world, along with music.
Tell me, do you think Richard Strauss had an agenda at all?
Richard Strauss had an agenda about promoting himself in many ways, because come on, a guy that wrote a piece called A Hero's Life, where the hero is himself, you know, he, like a great conductor and composer, had a huge ego. But nobody better could write the idea of the tone poem of telling great stories very clearly without having to say a word. And this was a man that perfected the art form of telling stories. Don Quixote, Till Eulenspiegel, Zarathustra, A Hero's Life, Aus Italien. I mean, all of these pieces, Sinfonia Domestica, which is about his own life, show presenting his own wife in the Heldenleben. You know, in Till Eulenspiegel presented the moment when he actually, where the guillotine comes down, you can hear it very clearly. So he perfected the art of telling a story by just using musical images. And I can promise you at the performance, you're going to see a lot of people with big smiles on their face, but at times there's going to be shock and sadness for this character. So Richard Strauss, I think in many ways, embodies the perfection of how classical music can be very serious, but at the same time, very lighthearted.
It's lovely. Thank you so much. Well, this has been such a pleasure to do this, Giancarlo. It's a wonderful set of two programs, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, I'm excited about the opportunity to work with the Boston Symphony again. And as I said, I'm getting to drive this amazing Ferrari. I'm just sorry that at the end of the concert, I'm going to have to return the keys. And I look forward for them to let me drive it around in the countryside next time, because it is one of the greatest privileges for a musician and for a conductor to get in front of one of the great orchestras on the face of this earth in such a beautiful natural setting.
That's Giancarlo Guerrero, who conducted the Boston Symphony Orchestra last summer at Tanglewood. And you'll hear that concert this weekend on Saturday night at 8 o'clock. You can also hear that concert on demand at classicalwcrb.org. Remember, you can subscribe to The Answered Question at iTunes or through your favorite podcast app. And you can also find TAQ at WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud feeds. Thanks to Harry Christophers and Giancarlo Guerrero, as well as the staffs of the Handel and Haydn Society and the Boston Symphony. And, of course, thanks to my colleague, Alan McClellan. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.